You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
You're a great professional. Well, tell me you're going to get absolutely rotten tonight, like me.
Possibly.
Come on, Jordan, go for it, lad. Enjoy yourself.
Cheers, Cara.
Cheers.
Welcome along, another Red Agenda, your Liverpool FC dedicated podcast. It looks like Jurgen's already working hard to bolster the Liverpool squad ahead of next season. Ibrahima Konate, the next new centre-half expected at Anfield. We're going to have a look at what he could bring to the defensive jigsaw. James Pearce, Simon Hughes and Kiva O'Neill with myself, Steve Hothersall, on the Red Agenda. Right, let's speak to David Ornstein, who broke this exclusively for The Athletic. So Liverpool, well, had to wait until the end of January for two centre-halves. Now it looks like they're lining up another one for the summer, David.
Yeah, like London buses, Steve, it's right. And if you remember, we've talked a lot on our various Athletic podcasts, and you've talked too about Liverpool for a long time now intending to strengthen at centre-half with a top recruit in the summer of 2021. That was always the plan. And of course, they hoped that even after the injuries to Virgil van Dijk and Joe Gomez, they could get through January with what they had, unless the situation got worse. It did get worse. They still tried to get through January until the very end when Kabak and Ben Davies came in. But I don't think that affected the wider picture, which the guys can tell you a lot more about, which, you know, Liverpool don't see themselves as a knee-jerk club. They don't see themselves as the type to throw money at a problem. They have a fantastic recruitment setup that is targeting players in every position throughout the year, working on their recruitment lists. And, you know, there'd been a lot of talk, and I know Simon had mentioned on a few occasions about Upamecano being in their thinking. Well, he then, of course, agreed to join Bayern Munich. And there were many people around RB Leipzig, Bundesliga, the French international setup, who have told us over time that actually Konate, however you want to pronounce it, is rated as the superior prospect than Upamecano. 21 years old, he's got all of the physical and technical attributes to be a world-class central defender. The concerns so far have been about his injury record, but I'm sure we'll go on to talk about that at greater length. So the situation is pretty much as we've explained in the story. Liverpool have stepped up their efforts to sign him. It's not a done deal and there is still work that needs to be done. But my understanding, and if it proves incorrect, I'll be the first to hold my hands up, is that he's the chosen candidate for Liverpool to bolster their central defence in the summer transfer window. He has a release clause, which is in the region. I think it's slightly above 40 million euros. And RB Leipzig are not in a financial position that dictates that they need to negotiate lower. So whoever buys him, and in this case, it looks like it will be Liverpool, will need to pay the release clause.
So would your understanding be, and you might not have the actual confirmation on this, that, you know, Ozan Kabak alongside him could be two new young centre-halves that are the future, really, because obviously Ozan Kabak's playing for his future as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting sub-question to all of this. And I was speaking to people about Kabak in the process of pulling this story together, and it was relayed to me that a decision needs to be made possibly around mid-May to Schalke on whether Liverpool intend to do that, take the £18 million plus add-ons clause. It really varies on who you speak to. Some say they're definitely going to send him back. Within those, some people think Liverpool will then try to negotiate a lower fee for him. Others say no chance, even with Schalke getting relegated, that a club that wants to buy talented 20-year-old, he's going to be going to the Euros with Turkey. He's started 7 games in a row so far for Liverpool. It's going to take a much higher fee. There's every chance, I guess, that Liverpool will try and bring both of those players on. But I don't have specific insight into that. And the guys will know better than me. I think that situation is undecided. I think there's a good chance that Kabak will return to Schalke. I don't think it's out of the question that Liverpool will end up signing him. But I don't think he was the primary target. I think the primary target is Ibrahima Konate.
Right, let's bring a couple of the guys in on this. James, we'll start with yourself because you've mentioned Upamecano a few times, but it seems like the sights were set elsewhere. What's your thoughts on this prospective deal?
I think it's a really interesting one. I think he certainly fits the bill, doesn't he, in terms of young, exciting talent that we know is usually the route that Liverpool go down. Klopp has spoken many times, hasn't he, about he's always more interested in signing, you know, the stars of tomorrow rather than the stars of today. So yeah, I think the only concern when you look at his record so far is the injuries, the fact that he has missed a fair bit of football in recent years. So I suppose that would be the one kind of concern from my point of view. But clearly, you know, it's an area that just simply has to be reinforced this summer, because this season exposed the folly of going into the season with only 3 senior recognised centre-backs. And I think the other big thing is there's such an unknown at the moment what kind of shape Van Dijk, Gomez, Matip are going to be in come next season. You know, how much football are you going to be able to get out of them? You know, is it realistic that one or two of them, you know, probably unrealistic to think all 3 would suddenly get back to somewhere near top level in the early months of the season? So it is a department of the squad that I think, you know, Liverpool probably do need 2 new faces this summer.
David, it was interesting you mentioned that the technical aspects he possesses. He's a quick player, isn't he? I mean, he's a big player. I think he's 6'4", but he's quick, and it very much fits the mould of the football Jurgen Klopp likes to play.
Yeah, and I'm going to point you straight towards a piece that's been written on The Athletic by Tom Warville, where he goes into a statistical analysis. But from what I've seen and from who I've spoken to about Konate, he's a towering presence. He's enormous. I think he's the tallest centre-back at RB Leipzig, and they've got an array of them. They've got more coming in, of course, and that's a point we should mention. Upamecano has been replaced by Simakan, and there is a young Croatian centre-back called Gvardiol, who a deal was agreed for, I think, in the winter, and he'll be arriving in the summer. They plan ahead very well, as do Liverpool in most cases. I know it's been a bit of a difficult time in January, but Liverpool, if they pull this off, it's a remarkably shrewd and swift early signing as they look to sort of make up for what's happened this season. Yeah, so tall, robust, incredibly well-built, brings the ball out of defence. There have been some comparisons, just listening this morning to some German reporters, to Virgil van Dijk in the way that he plays. I think he tends to be on the right side, if I'm not mistaken, and Virgil van Dijk more often towards the left. Although last night for the France under 21 side that was victorious in their latest under 21 Euros game, he did play on the left side of central defence. So there's a bit of versatility there. His speed, he's said to be renowned for, and Tom goes into detail on that in the piece. I think he relinquishes possession quite a lot. And so that's going to be a work in progress. But equally, it's almost like fortune favours the brave. He tends to want to bring the ball out a lot and try things that maybe many other centre-halves in Europe don't want to try. There's this band of centre-halves coming through, Upamecano, Sven Botman. You've even got the likes of Koundé at Sevilla and Kabak even. And when you bring all of those together and you look at their physical, technical aspects, Konate is, according to many people that we speak to in the game, is viewed as being having the highest bar. Now, there are so many variables, how it develops, his fitness, etc. But if Liverpool managed to do this deal, more informed people than me on that technical aspect you talk about, Steve, say that he could really be an absolute steal, even at 40 million, if you think he could be a starting centre half for the next decade and beyond. So if they can get this deal done, I think it'd be very exciting. And there is other interest in him. I think the likes of Manchester United and Chelsea have been rumoured. But my latest information is that Liverpool have stolen a march on their rivals for him and are in pole position to get the deal done.
Top, top exclusive. David, thank you very much indeed for your time. Make sure you're a subscriber to The Athletic. In order to read the article, head to theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. Sign up for just £1 a week. That's 40% discount for just listening to the podcast. You can also hear more from David on the Ornstein and Chapman podcast. David, thank you.
Thank you very much, guys.
Right, let's hear now from our German football correspondent, Raphael Honigstein, who's got more information about this possible signing of Ibrahima Konate.
When I spoke to Ralf Rangnick, the former RB sporting director, back in August, when I was doing a Dire Upamecano piece, I remember distinctly him mentioning Ibrahima Konate and saying that in his view, Konate was just as good, perhaps not quite as obvious in his game, but in terms of potential and in terms of underlying skill set, that he was just as good as Dario Upamecano and a potential world-class player going forward. He also mentioned that they're a little bit different in the way that they play. Upamecano relies a lot on his physique, on his pace, whereas Konate is more of a technical player. Of course, he's very tall, he's very strong, but his game is a lot to do with anticipation, with intelligence, with positioning. So not too dissimilar to Virgil van Dijk in many ways, who he was compared with by the official Bundesliga.com website not long ago. So all in all, if he can stay fit and if Liverpool indeed can get this over the line, I think a hugely exciting transfer, especially in consideration of his youth. I mean, this could be the defender next to Van Dijk for the next 10 years, at least until Van Dijk retires. So a long-term solution potentially for Liverpool, and a player I think that's going to do really, really well, if indeed it works out.
Let's get some more thoughts on this possible signing. So Ibrahima Konate, I think that's the correct pronunciation. Simon Hughes will have it down to a T. Another centre-back for Liverpool squad. Couldn't find one in January. I mentioned this to David before. It's important that the planning's being done, though, at this stage, isn't it? Great exclusive from David there. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think you got your pronunciation right, Steve, so that's a good start. I know you struggle with some of these names from time to time. I've got to be honest. I mean, it's sort of, I only came across the news last night, and so obviously been furiously trying to do a bit of research on who he is and what he's capable of. And I know David's mentioned there when he was speaking about Tom Warville's piece on The Athletic and told me a lot of things that I didn't know. You know, it was very, very scientific, the report that he's done. And the thing that sort of jumps out at me, he's obviously got pace. And I think that is something that Liverpool perhaps have lost throughout this season, you know, in terms of the whole strategy of the pressing game that they want to play. If they don't have that pace at the back where they can take those risks higher up the pitch, the whole thing sort of falls down. So it's quite clear that he's got that pace. But as everything with Liverpool, they're always sort of left field signings. And I can understand that there will be question marks over his appearance record over the last couple of seasons when he had an injury that ruled him out, I think, from October to June, the season before last, and has obviously missed a chunk of football this season as well. So he's only 21 and very powerful in the air as well. I think that's perhaps something that Liverpool have missed at times. I know obviously Nat Phillips, when he plays, he brings that power and that commanding presence. But without Virgil van Dijk, and when Phillips doesn't play, I think they do lack a bit of physicality. So I think that's important as well. So ticks some of the most important boxes that you're looking for in terms of a Liverpool defender and a Klopp defender, I should say. Because, I mean, it's been quite interesting this week, isn't it? I think, like, sort of a touch on that. You know, it's very important to be a Klopp defender in this Liverpool team. You look at some of the players that have done well for Liverpool, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Curtis Jones, not getting a sniff at international level. I do sometimes wonder whether that's because of the very specific nature of the way Liverpool play is quite different to what a lot of other teams play. So, yeah, I think you're going to have to come tools with the very specifics of what Klopp asks for out of players. And he does seem to have some of the most important elements of that.
He's obviously had those injuries, but I think the club must be confident that fitness isn't a concern. He's played a fair number of games, Champions League, Bundesliga as well, Kiva. How does it manifest itself longer term with what Liverpool already have? So Virgil van Dijk, Joe Gomez, Matip's still there. Nat Phillips has been great. Ozan Kabak's playing for his future. How does this signing fit into what Liverpool are aiming for?
I mean, it feels so nice to actually just think of a list of defenders that are actually capable of playing for Liverpool, doesn't it? I think it's an interesting one now. You know, obviously, if Konate does sign for Liverpool, then you kind of wonder sort of, will Liverpool then want to sign Kabak for the 18 million? I think they probably should, just because he's proven himself in recent weeks, and I'm sure he will do throughout the season. He was impressive the other night as Turkey beat the Netherlands, which is no mean feat. So, you know, he's a really talented young player and someone I think who could long-term maybe partner Konate. And I think it's good to have those, to have as many defenders pretty much as possible. Liverpool now need forevermore, because we can't ever let this happen again. I feel like that's kind of the standpoint of a lot of fans. But I think when you think of someone then like Nat Phillips, it's kind of like he's done so well and he's kind of like become this cult hero that none of us really expected. He probably didn't himself. And I mean, Liverpool would probably make more money on him this summer selling him, wouldn't they? You'd imagine his fee would have doubled just because of the experience he's now garnered and, you know, what he's shown he can do. But he's one of those players that I kind of think, would you not just keep him around as well? But, you know, I guess we'll have to see how things go. Just with, like, James made a really important point earlier, you know, Joel Matip, Joe Gomez and Virgil van Dijk, they're not going to walk into the team next season after their injury and be the same player that they was before. Like, that's so rare to happen. Maybe van Dijk might do it just because he's some Martian we plucked from outer space. But other than him, it's kind of like you do worry about how long it'll take them to get to grips with playing week in, week out again. And that might take a longer time. Like, next season might be written off in some sort of, maybe for the odd one there, you'd imagine. They're not going to come back and just be amazing. And if they are, then I'll hold my hands up and say, great, that's amazing. But I think you're not best to have as many defenders, like I've said there. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like Kabak's done enough to earn himself a Liverpool move. He wants to come to Liverpool. You've seen that from the day he signed. He'd sent Schalke a goodbye message, hadn't he? You know, he's very much focused on becoming a Liverpool player long term. Then there's obviously Nat Phillips, Reece Williams as well, who'd be kicking about. You know, he's done a really impressive job this season, hasn't he? And I'm sure he'll continue to sort of impress as the years go on. He's someone good to have there. But yeah, I think in terms of sort of defenders, just sign all of them, keep all of them. That's where we're at.
What's it does, Kiva? It's just great to be talking about signings, isn't it, James? I think at this, I don't know how busy this summer's going to be. We've touched on that before, haven't we? But this is an early shot. I don't know whether the fact the Euros happens this summer as well is maybe puts a little bit in something in the minds of clubs, thinking that they have to maybe plan for the summer a bit quicker.
Possibly, yeah. Although I do think in general, planning for Liverpool at the moment is difficult because they don't know whether they're going to be playing Champions League football next season. So that is going to have a sizable impact on what they do and don't do in the market because of the huge financial implications of making it or not. And you know, as it is at the moment, there's still two potential routes to making sure they are still amongst Europe's elite next season. So yeah, I mean, of course, at the moment, it's, you know, as David said, his information is reasonably well advanced, certainly not done. But I think, you know, I think centre back is that area of the squad, isn't it? That almost it's such an absolute priority that, you know, regardless of whether and also with the greatest respect, someone of his age and experience isn't going to be swayed either way, Konate, is he, by whether Liverpool are in the top four or not? You know, I don't think he's the kind of one you'd look at and go, well, he's not at that age. He's not going to be adamant that he has to play Champions League football at the age of 21. But yeah, I think it is going to be intriguing how Klopp does handle that this summer with, as Kiva said, Nat Phillips hasn't put a foot wrong, has he? But is he of sufficient calibre for Liverpool to seriously have a go at getting the Premier League title back next season? And then obviously you've got to factor in Reece Williams, you've got to factor in Billy Cometio. You know, I think, you know, Cometio hasn't kicked on as people expected this season, but he's still a young player at Liverpool, a young French centre-off that they've got. you know, still big hopes for. But yeah, I just think because of everything that's happened with the injuries and because it's just been exposed so badly this season, that is the one area that it's just by far and away the biggest priority. Certainly more important than anything else I can think of that is on Klopp's to-do list this summer.
James, you mentioned the effect of not having Champions League football. What is the concern regarding the bigger players of not having Champions League football? Would we be led to believe that they have full commitment to the club and that heads wouldn't be turned to go elsewhere, considering maybe the age of some of the star players?
Yeah, well, Klopp was asked about this recently, wasn't he? And he was absolutely adamant that he would get the loyalty that he expected from all of his key players this summer in terms of, you know, he dismissed it in terms of like, because he was, you know, asked, you know, do you fear anyone saying, well, no, at this stage in my career, I need to be playing Champions League. And I mean, obviously, the one that I think people keep on going back to is Mohamed Salah, isn't it? In terms of, you know, if Liverpool were to miss out on the top four, would that then prompt him to look around for a new challenge? But at the moment, there's absolutely no suggestions that that is the case. And even when you go back to, you know, the interview in AS and the things we've talked about before, and, you know, the cryptic tweets from agents, you know, I still think a lot of that is designed to getting him a new contract rather than getting him a move. Because I think the other thing is, you know, who is going to have, you know, I don't know, I think it's quite difficult to put a value on someone like Salah, but if you're talking 100, 120, 150 million or something, who's going to be able to spend that kind of money this summer? You know, certainly not Barcelona with the absolute financial state that they're in. I'm not sure Real Madrid are either. I don't even think there's going to be too many people trying to, with the financial backing required, to try and tempt anyone away.
That was a really worrying time being a Rangers fan, not knowing if you'd have a team to support or not.
The Scottish Football League's only acceptable position will be to place Rangers FC into the third division.
It wasn't so much a football match you were involved in as a test of manhood.
And with your support along the way, we will get back to where we belong.
From the bottom to the top, the journey is over. Rangers are back.
It all ended spectacularly in Europe when he had an argument with Rangers fans in a bush.
It's a huge honour for me to be sat here now to be the manager of Rangers, and you know the excitement levels are very difficult to contain at the moment.
Drilled by Arfield, Conor Goldson looking to score again, and he has scored again, and Rangers are in such a good place now.
Everybody in Scotland was talking about 10 this at the start of the season, and the only number they're now talking about is 55.
To get the full story of the fall and rise of Rangers, subscribe now to Beyond the Headline.
It's the Red Agenda. I'm Steve Hothersall on the pod today. Simon Hughes, Kiva O'Neill, James Pearce. So 9 games to go. The run-in's quite favourable. Let's just have a look at a couple of things that might happen between now and the end of the season. Si, can we pick up on Jordan Henderson? First of all, I think in the past couple of weeks, we've been thinking, you know, maybe he could make the latter stages of the Champions League. And then maybe Gareth Southgate threw in a bomb and suggested that even his involvement in the Euros had a question mark against it. I know you wouldn't know any specifics, but given the injury he's had, is maybe the expectation that he doesn't play for Liverpool again this season?
That's not what I was sort of told at the beginning when he got injured, unless that's changed over the last week or so. I mean, I guess Gareth Southgate's got a lot of options in that area of the pitch, and he's just tempering expectations. I mean, I think with that sort of injury that he's had, it's always particularly difficult to gauge the reality of where he's actually going to return, because I do tend to find that Liverpool put a, you know, sort of a conservative estimate on when a player is going to be longer. And sometimes when he's going to be longer, it seems like he might come back in a shorter space of time. Trying to get sort of that sense of accuracy with Liverpool is quite difficult. I think partly that's because of, again, the very unique and acute demands of what it takes to train for Liverpool and play for Liverpool. I mean, I just think, you know, if Liverpool can get him back on the pitch playing in midfield, it's just going to be a massive, massive bonus for Liverpool, and will put them in a really good place. if you've got, you know, potentially having Henderson and Thiago and Fabinho playing in the same team, which they haven't been able to do since the derby at Goodison Park, you know, I think it'll put them in a strong position. But then equally, you know, getting players coming back at the end of the season from tricky injuries isn't always ideal, because they sometimes rush back too quickly and keen to be involved, and it doesn't necessarily always end up the way you want it to. But yeah, I mean, the information that I had recently was that he was on course to return to the team, sort of the squad and training April time. So unless Gareth Southgate's probably in a better position than me to know about where a player is in terms of his injury, but I suppose he's just hedging his bets, like a lot of international managers will be at the moment with players who have injuries. They have to deal with what they know for certain. I think with the tournament being so close, you know, it's only less than 2 months away now. So I think he'll be looking to work with the players that he knows are available for this time, for this moment in time.
Yeah, I hope we see him. Let's look at the season itself, and obviously 9 games to play, Kiefer. The noises coming out of some of the Liverpool players are what you want to hear. Andy Robertson says there's still time to fix things. Sadio Mane says there's got to show the fight that's required. Is there time to fix things? 9 games?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, you've got to just get wins on the board, and that's pretty much from a fan's perspective. You know, maybe that won't, 9 wins won't let Liverpool into the Champions League next season, because, you know, Chelsea or whoever don't falter in that time. But I think going into next season, this is a springboard almost, isn't it? Just for positivity, even just to get wins, get a run together, because, you know, we saw that run earlier in the season and then it obviously collapsed, and Liverpool have sort of been trying to get it going again. So I feel like if they can do that in the latter part of this season, then I think that just bodes well going into next season, whether or not they're able, you know, to surmount the points difference that the currently is to Chelsea and Leicester and the like. So, I mean, it feels like it might just be out of Liverpool's reach at the minute, but then you just really never know. I think that starts with the game against Arsenal. You know, you've got to put a win and run together, and I think that'll help them as well, obviously going into those massive games against Real Madrid in the Champions League. And, you know, as we've said last week and weeks before on the pod with this Liverpool team and, you know, Liverpool's history, you can never really say never, can you? So, yeah, I think it's more about next season now. I think that's maybe why you're seeing that news sort of emerge this morning. You know, the plans are already ahead, thinking, you know, the Premier League title isn't quite in Man City's hands, but it soon will be. And, you know, I'm sure that'll be painful for everyone concerned with Liverpool, you know, when considering what a point they were in at the turn of the year to, you know, towards now where we're at in the season. But, you know, there's still, I think it's been a nice break to sort of just take a step back probably and think about, you know, what needs to be done, a little bit of rest for some players who've probably needed it. And then, you know, there's others out there on international duty as well. And I think it's just now, it's time now, isn't it, to put that run together. And we've got the Euros and probably the never-ending sort of couple of seasons will continue.
Yeah, James, you did a piece on this break, didn't you? It's obviously a 20-day period in which some of them can rest and maybe recuperate a little bit. Others are out on the international duty. I just wonder what it does. There's always an expectation on Liverpool, even though there's a general feeling that it might be impossible to qualify for the top four. They still live with an expectation now, don't they, till the end of the season?
Yeah, and I don't think it's completely out of the question. Was it the gap, I think, to Chelsea is 5 points at the moment. And yeah, there's a few other teams in between Liverpool and Chelsea that they'd have to slip up as well. But I think by the nature of this season, we've seen that, you know, if you can put a run together, then you can climb the table pretty quickly. So it's not out of the question. And I know, like, you know, lots of people say, oh, you know, Liverpool are terrible and they have a long break because, you know, you lose that rhythm and all the rest of it. But I actually thought, despite the couple of wins Liverpool had before the break, I thought they still looked really tired, you know, psychologically probably as much as physically. So I think the break will do them good. And, you know, I don't think it's just clutching at straws to think that Liverpool can still salvage something decent out of this season. Because I think, you know, there's signs there of a centre-back partnership that actually works with Phillips and Kabak. You know, we've seen the impact of having Fabinho back in midfield. Jota, again, you know, how good has he looked on international duty in recent days as well? You know, he Jota's a player there that at a time when a lot of Premier League footballers will be feeling the strain, he should be probably as fresh as anyone with, you know, with the time off that he's had because of that knee injury. And so, yeah, and I'm really looking forward to that Champions League tie against Real Madrid, because I just think they are beatable. And yes, it'll be a massive test for those two centre-halves. But even with the way Real Madrid are, they're not the kind of team, they don't have an Mbappe or a Haaland that's going to absolutely tear you to shreds with pace. You know, and we know that Klopp, you know, Klopp's record in two-legged European ties is just ridiculously good. And yeah, and that, you know, that draw has whetted the appetite, because pretty much everyone you would want to avoid is on the other half of the draw. Yeah, and you start to dream about Istanbul in late May.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
It's your Liverpool podcast, The Red Agenda. Really nice to hear Liverpool announcing season ticket plans for next season. Manchester United have done the same as well, but prices frozen at Anfield, which is obviously great. 10,000 fans could be back inside Anfield for the last game of the season. And I just want to direct you to a piece that Simon wrote perhaps a couple of weeks ago, but worth scrolling back on your Athletic timeline to find it, because a fair bit of emotion, I thought, in what you were writing just about missing that proper footballing feeling, Si.
Yeah, I hate this sort of football world at the moment, so I won't lie. The lack of fans, obviously I miss going to the game, but even when you watch the football on TV, for me, it's not the way I sort of want to watch football, even on TV with a lack of fans there. Still feels like a totally different game. And yeah, just the sooner people get back inside stadiums, the better for everybody, for all number of reasons, obviously.
Better for the players as well. Did you see those Thiago quotes where he said about the psychological impact of playing without fans?
Yeah, well, I just always think, you know, like people say, oh, well, it's been the same for every fan base, which I think is absolute nonsense, to be honest, because on that basis, every fan base has the same collective identity, the same history. Which obviously we know isn't the case. So we know that certain fan bases will act differently according to situations that are going on the pitch. And I do think that Liverpool, I mean, there's no surprise to me that Sheffield United have obviously suffered off the back of the pandemic and a lack of fans. They were flying at home and, you know, and away when obviously things changed. And I'm just absolutely convinced that Liverpool wouldn't have gone six games on the bounce. Well, so six defeats at home on the bounce on a losing streak. I just don't think the fans would have allowed that to happen. Almost, I understand. I'm not saying that Anfield is a really positive place all of the time, but I detected a bit of revisionism actually in sort of some of the reporting around the situation, because, you know, a few people saying, well, I've been in Anfield and it can be a really touchy atmosphere. It's like, well, it can't have been that touchy because they went unbeaten 3 years on the, you know, on the run. So it can't have been that bad for the players, can it? It's all part of the same thing. I think the fact that there's a lack of fans and then VAR being rolled into the conversation around football at the same time just feels like all the emotions just being stripped away. I mean, I sort of compared VAR to, it's a bit like, you know, when you go away on holiday and you get to passport control and you've got this glum looking immigration official who doesn't know whether to let you to get into the country or to hold you back, and then suddenly you're allowed in, and then not only that, he follows you around for the rest of your holiday telling you whether you can go and have a drink or go to a nightclub or something. It just feels, that's how football feels to me. It's like police state. And so that rolls into the lack of fans just feels like the whole emotion, any sort of unpredictability about the game is being lost. The one thing I'd say about, I mean, I think I mentioned it to you before, Steve, on the podcast, so I apologise, I repeat myself, but I always think back to that. In fact, we mentioned it last week, didn't we, about the Chelsea game in 2005. You know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the linesman in that game absolutely shat himself, basically, when he realised he had the decision to make up whether the ball had or had not crossed the line. And if that game had been taking place somewhere else, I don't think that Liverpool had just taken the lead at that time, put it that way. So, yeah, the sooner the better, fans back in. I think it'll just feel like the football that I know, because it isn't just about what happens on the pitch for me.
The game will feel like the game again. Right, let's finish off the Red Agenda with a chat about cult heroes. Well, we'll ask all three of you. A quick answer then. So, Si, a cult hero to you would be, don't give a reason, who, just a name.
Steve, this is, you know what, right, there is a reason.
Come on, give me one.
All right, well, Divock Origi is the most recent cult hero. Oh,
Divock, eh? Yeah. Kiva.
I'll have to go with a recent one as well. More for the no context page on Twitter, but Joel Matip, it's got to be.
Do you know what? I would have said the person that James has written about. I'm not just saying it because he's written about it. He has been one of my favourite players, honestly. Javier Mascherano.
Why does James get preferential treatment?
Is he your favourite?
Me and Steve just click.
What a player. An absolute machine, a destroyer. I loved him at that. Even when he left under that cloud, and I used to have this argument with some of my friends saying, you know, to me, a proper midfielder who just took no hostages. Wonderful when he was playing at his best for Liverpool, James. So you've written a piece on Javier Mascherano and why Rafa was so intent on bringing him.
Yeah, it was enjoyable actually to revisit. But there are loads of great Mascherano tales and anecdotes. And when you think that, you know, when Rafa made his secret trip to Mascherano's flat in Canary Wharf, I think it was just after Christmas 2006. You know, he was wallowing in West Ham's reserves, wasn't he? You know, Hayden Mullins and Nigel Quasi were getting picked in the team that looked like they were going to get relegated ahead of him, and you know, within what, 4 or 5 months after that, he's walking out in the Champions League final in Athens, and probably him and Jermaine Pennant were Liverpool's best players on the night. And yeah, I think the reason what reminded me about why fans just took to him so much is just all the stories about just he immersed himself in the history of the club. Like, he wanted to learn everything about the past, and you know, the local staff members, he'd send them messages the night before games against Everton and United saying, you know, we're doing this for you tomorrow, and probably worked himself into too much of a frenzy at times with I don't think it was a great coincidence that two of his three red cards were against United. But yeah, I think just John Arnerisa, one of the players I spoke, just said he was just the perfect teammate, he said, in every possible way, because he said he had this amazing balance between, you know, in training and in matches. He was like a man possessed, like his life that absolutely depended on, you know, the following hour or 90 minutes. But then when it was done, he was like a completely different fella, this, like, you know, doting family man, and, you know, having a laugh and joke with his teammates. And I know obviously he does divide opinion, you know, that it reminded me of that again, you know, when I saw some of the reaction on Twitter to the piece at the weekend, because of the way things finished for him. But I'm with you, Steve. I think the club was such a mess back then. You know, he was so close to Benitez. And I know, you know, Barcelona as well, he came knocking in 2009. He was essentially told, look, we can't lose Alonso and Mascherano this summer. You're going to have to sit tight. So, you know, in his head, he was always going in the summer of 2010. And then obviously, you know, the club implodes, the issues with Hicks and Gillette, Benitez loses his job, and then he's still getting messed about and felt like he'd had promises that were broken by Christian Perslow. And, you know, and I think having Roy Hodgson as your new manager is probably enough to convince anyone it's time to move on. So, yeah, obviously, you know, there was a bit of a PR game, I think, that went on around the fact he missed that game against Manchester City at the Etihad, and the club were briefing that he refused to play. But as Jamie Carragher said in that piece, he said, you know, you can't really complain, because, you know, players have done that to get moves to Liverpool in the past. So, you know, it was just one of those things. And I think also when you look back now with the passage of time, you know, when you look at what he went on to achieve after he left Liverpool, I think 5 La Ligas, 2 Champions League triumphs at Barca. I don't think you could say that he made too many bad career decisions.
Just a shame, Simon, that we didn't see that sort of combination with Gerard Alonso and Mascherano a little bit longer. Because let's face it, when they were in full flow, he allowed the two of them to actually do what they were brilliant at.
Well, I mean, what a midfield. I mean, they should have won the league in 08, 09, I still think it's still a major regret, really. I think because there wasn't that moment where it almost fell away from Liverpool. Liverpool were always catching up. It's not seen as a historically a major disappointment, and it's not the sort of thing that I suppose other fan groups would latch on to, because Liverpool were always sort of behind Man United for a long period of time, playing catch-up, and they had too much work to do. But I absolutely loved Mascherano. I mean, I wouldn't say that I got to know, but I did interview him a few times. And, you know, as James said, he was an angry little man on the pitch, wasn't he? You could imagine him sort of playing, you know, for a team based on Scotland Road, couldn't you? Like, just totally 100% commitment on the pitch. He was brilliant. But off the pitch, you know, he really surprised me how sort of engaging he was. You know, like, some of the players of that time, and I suppose a lot of players since, when they do interviews, you know, sometimes that you can sense that they don't want to be there. But Mascherano would always tell you exactly sort of what he thought. He was the most honest person, one of the most honest people I've ever come across, really, in football, in that sense. And he had an opinion on most things. I was quite surprised, because he wasn't from, like, Buenos Aires. He was from out in the sticks and somewhere near Rosario, I think. So it's not like he was like this sort of urban person who'd come through the hard streets of Buenos Aires. I'm not saying that his upbringing was easy, but, you know, he'd come from a long way to get to where he was. Just a really interesting character. And, I wish he'd have played for Liverpool a bit longer. I mean, all I can say is, on the pitch, you never sense that he gave anything but 100%. I mean, I remember him filling in it right back in some games, you know, at Stoke, and performed brilliantly. He was Argentinian captain, and he had the humility to fill in it right back for Liverpool while he had Kyriakos alongside him, I think, which I think shows you a lot. It sort of illustrates where Liverpool were at the time. But despite the way he left, I think he did love playing for Liverpool. And I always remember that interview that he gave after he won the Champions League for Barcelona, beating Man United at Wembley. And he made a point, didn't he, of saying, you know, I know the Liverpool fans don't like me, and I can understand why some fans don't like me, but he said, you know, we just beat Man United and this is for you. I remember him saying that, and I thought, it's quite a big thing to say, you know, sort of just at your moments of you just achieved something for the first time in your career, and he remembered to make a point of saying it. It was, like, really important to him. So it was an ambition of mine to get out to La Plata, where he was playing, his last club, and go and interview him, because I'm sure he'd have made a great interview. I can't imagine that he's just going to retire from football and that'll be the end of him. He just doesn't seem to be that sort of character. I think he's got too many views on things to just drift away. I can imagine him getting involved, whether it be in coaching or some sort of political level of football. I think his name's going to be floating around for quite some time, I suspect.
James, I remember vividly the chaos he caused he didn't cause it, but when Diego turned up at Melwood to tell him he was going to be Argentina captain. And it was like the Queen, you know, it was like the biggest person in the world had come to actually give him this audience. I remember getting a phone call in the morning that this is happening at Melwood today. And that sort of epitomizes the craziness, I think, as well, that went round his life.
Yeah, it says a lot about Mascherano, doesn't it? The fact that Diego Maradona, I think Maradona had only just taken over as Argentina manager. That was one of his first acts, was to come to Melwood and formally ask him to take over as captain. He was. That is the one regret, isn't it? That it's crazy that someone as good as Mascherano didn't win anything during his time at Liverpool, and that midfield. You know, I just don't think if you were trying to, like, design in a laboratory a three-man midfield, I'm not sure you would come up with anything better than Mascherano, Alonso, Gerrard, and as a trio together is definitely a source of regret.
Steve, have I ever told my Maradona story when he came to Anfield? I know I put it on Twitter a while ago.
Your dear friend Diego?
Dear friend Diego, yeah. We kept in touch until the last days. Yeah, when he obviously came to watch, I think he came to watch Mascherano and Maxi Rodriguez, I think, Europa League game. Maradona was at Anfield, and it was in the old main stands, and in the, like, sort of the landing outside, inside, just by the staircase. It was very busy at half time, and Maradona walks through, and it's almost like silence. You could just suck the air out the room. And everybody just stood still, like, staring at Maradona. nobody knew what to say. I remember Phil Thompson was like in the like sort of maybe five or 10 yards away, and some lads just blurted out, "All right, there, Diego, lads," like that, and just everyone just fell about laughing, you know. And Phil Thompson was just in bulk. Maradona just gave this lad the thumbs up, you know. It was brilliant, so funny. Like that's the theatre that Mascherano brought to Liverpool.
Absolutely brilliant. You can read all about it in that piece that James has written on The Athletic right now. Also another one on cult heroes, which is on there at the moment. Just before we go, a line from Kiva on Liverpool women's. You've written about Kerry Holland, so just give us a headline on this one, Kiva.
It was really, really good to interview Kerry last week. You can read the interview obviously on The Athletic. She's joined the club in January, and obviously it's a difficult time at the minute. They're still searching for a women's manager. So, you know, she came into the club when things were almost falling apart. They just got beat by Leicester, which sort of, you know, ended the hopes of getting promotion back to the WSL. And she's come in, I think that was her fifth game yesterday. She scored three cracking goals, you know, in the games before that. Yesterday she was brilliant. You know, she's just the bright spark Liverpool women have needed. So you can read that interview, which is, you know, touches on, I think, a late granddad from Wales. He was a big Liverpool fan. And she said it was quite emotional when she pulled on the red shirt for the first time. But obviously it's more difficult without families being able to be at the ground. And I think that's something we sometimes forget, because we're always talking about fans, but, you know, the players' families are always there at the games with them. And I think that's probably one of those big psychological impacts that they're having, you know, not being able to have the nearest and dearest there. But yeah, it was really great to chat to Kerry, and I think she's going to be one of Liverpool's best players in the years to come. There's no doubt about that.
And the other headline out of this one, something that Simon will relate to, apparently before every game she eats a plate of beans on toast. Pre-match meal. Si, your pre-match meal, what is it?
In terms of before watching a game or playing?
Before the game? Beans on toast?
Yeah, well, before playing, I did actually used to have beans on toast, but yeah, it obviously didn't do me any good.
Okay, James?
Pasta. Got to be a bowl of pasta, Steve.
Oh, look at him. Proper athlete. Brilliant stuff. James, Si, Kiva, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to David Ornstein as well. Check out that exclusive, of course, and what could be a brand new signing in the summer. We certainly hope that's one that crosses the line. Thanks for listening to The Red Agenda. Back in a week.
The Athletic.